Bryant Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great day when we confront a great question which is puzzling to lots of conservatives. How come conservatives and Republicans did so well in this election, particularly with House seats, with Senate seats, with state legislative seats? I mean, the numbers are truly extraordinary. The GOP gained a total of 192 seats in state houses of representatives across the country and 40 state Senate seats. The Republicans flipped control of three different chambers of state legislatures. So how come all of that went on at a time when President Trump was losing the presidential election? We'll talk to John McCormick of National Review, who has posed that question. We'll ask him, is it possible that any kind of election fraud had something to do with the fact that Trump did less well than other Republicans on the ballot? We will get to that on the Medved show. We'll also take a look at a new effort to remove the word black from a student curricula and from term papers and from a university discourse in general. Where, why? We will get to that on the Michael Medved show. But first up, we are not out of the woods, despite all of the optimistic news which we covered yesterday about the Moderna vaccine. There are now several vaccines, all of which seem very promising. There are reports from the Department of Health and Human Services that they may actually begin distributing these vaccines before Christmas. That's right, before Christmas, which would be a wonderful thing. I think that is a kind of news that has helped to propel the stock market, which again today had a good day to begin the month of December, what people are hoping will be a Santa Claus rally. The Dow Jones Industrials up 185 points and approaching again that 30,000 mark. But we still have other numbers that are desperately grim, and they are numbers that involve the COVID-19 coronavirus. As the New York Times writes in a very substantive, large piece where they interviewed literally scores of top public health experts, a piece by Donald G. McNeil Jr. "The nation must now endure," he writes, "a critical period of transition, one that threatens to last far too long. As we set aside a justifiable optimism about next spring and confront the dark winter ahead, some epidemiologists predict that the death toll by March could be close to twice the 250,000 figure that the nation surpassed only last week." In other words, if you take December, January, February, those 3 months, we could lose the same number of people to death that we have lost so far in the first, 9 months of the pandemic. "The next 3 months are going to be just horrible," said Dr. Ashish Jha, who is the dean of Brown University's School of Public Health, which is very well respected School of Public Health. He was one of two dozen experts interviewed by The Times about the immediate future. "By late December, the first doses of vaccine may be available to Americans," federal officials have said. "Priorities are still being set, but vaccinations are expected to go first to healthcare workers, nursing home residents, and others at highest risk. But even as the medical response to the virus is improving," The Times writes that the politics of public health remain a deeply vexing challenge. "The regions of the country now among those hit hardest by the virus, Midwestern and mountain states and rural counties, including in the Dakotas, Iowa, Nebraska, and Wyoming, are the ones that voted most heavily for Mr. Trump in the recent election. The president could help save his millions of supporters, writes McNeil, by urging them to wear masks to avoid crowds and skip holiday gatherings this year. But that seemed unlikely to occur, health experts said. William Schaffner, who is a preventive medicine specialist at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, said that is outside of President Trump's DNA. It would mean admitting he was wrong and Tony Fauci was right. Had Mr. Trump heeded his medical advisors in late spring and adopted measures to curb new infections, the nation could now be on track to exit the pandemic next year with far fewer deaths per capita than many other nations. But during his campaign, Mr. Trump spent little time explaining the importance of Operation Warp Speed, even while he was devoting great energy and resources to it, I might add. Some health experts expressed concern that Mr. Trump might continue to undermine the coronavirus effort after he leaves office by contradicting and diminishing any new measures proposed by President-elect Biden. The antidote to hopelessness is agency, and Americans can protect themselves by wearing masks and keeping their distance from others. Reluctant officials are finally coming around to ordering such measures. The governors of Iowa and New Hampshire, both Republicans, by the way, issued mask mandates for the first time last month. The governors of Kansas and North Carolina and Hawaii strengthened their mask mandates. But average Americans are sharply divided over masks. This is one of those things I honest to goodness don't understand. In other words, even if masks are not a cure-all, and they're not, there seems to be a complete consensus, unanimity, that they help, that it reduces your risk of not just infecting yourself, but of infecting other people. And it's such a minor inconvenience. I know they don't look great. They don't feel great. And sometimes, you know, makes it tougher to talk, or certainly makes it tougher to eat. But come on, masks? Is that really such a big deal worth fighting and risking over? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued new guidelines on November 10th, saying more clearly than ever before that everyone, infected or not, should wear a mask. Studies show that high-quality masks can significantly reduce the spread of pathogens between people in conversation. And the common-sense evidence that masks work has become overwhelming. Dozens of super spreader events have taken place in venues where most people were not masked. In contrast, none have been known to occur in venues where most people wore masks, such as grocery stores. One well-known CDC study showed that even in a Springfield, Missouri hair salon where two stylists were infected, not one of the 139 customers whose hair they cut over the course of 10 days caught the disease. A city health order had required that both the stylists and the customers be masked. Okay. A study by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington estimated that 130,000 lives could be saved by February, if mask use became universal in the United States immediately. Masks can also preserve the economy. A study by Goldman Sachs estimated that universal use could save $1 trillion that may be lost to business shutdowns and medical bills. So what else needs to be done politically and medically? We'll get to it. Santa Claus is coming to town. And on the Michael Medved Show, the good news is that we will have effective vaccines. The bad news is that we're not going to have them until probably sometime near the end of the year. Not for wide distribution until the beginning of next year. And so what happens between now and then? There's also a great deal of concern that surveys and marketing studies show that a big chunk of Americans are not eager to take the vaccine. And there's going to have to be a massive public health effort. In fact, some of the public health experts that are quoted in this piece in the New York Times say that they may need to do mandatory vaccines. And how would that work? I mean, what if you just don't want it? You don't want your kids to take it and you don't want to take it? Well, the fact is they would do mandatory vaccines, for instance, if you want to get admitted into a school, if you want to function in a school, if you want to work at a place of business. Should it come to that? I certainly hope not. But one of the things that is a factor, and this is actually a quote from Dr. Lincoln, who is involved with a Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And he says, we're facing extremely complex and poorly understood dynamics around disinformation, conspiratorial theories, paranoia, and mistrust. Others said that the panel that was put together by Joe Biden, which is supposed to take over from President Trump's coronavirus task force, that the panel put together by the president-elect had too many members who were tied to the old Obama-Biden administration, including Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, for example, who was an architect of the Affordable Care Act, and Dr. Eric Goosby was Mr. Obama's global AIDS coordinator. To reach all of America, said these experts, Mr. Biden's panel needs credible Republican experts. That's entirely true. And that, frankly, was one of the problems with President Trump's coronavirus task force, is there was nobody from the other side. It is completely crucial if Biden is going to have any kind of success at all in reducing the suffering and saving lives, is completely crucial that he brings on, and including some Republicans who may be both politicians and physicians. Like if you talk about Senator Kennedy from Louisiana, who is a physician, or Senator Rand Paul, who is a physician. Somebody from the other side is crucial. To reach Mr. Trump's base, they said the panel needs credible Republican experts. Otherwise, said Dr. Leanna Wen, a former Baltimore health commissioner, there will be even more of a mistaken perception that this is Democrats and doctors trying to shut down the economy when actually controlling the virus is the key to economic recovery. And by the way, isn't that obviously true? That if the economy is going to get humming and get to back to where it was, that we can't be looking at more than 2,000 deaths a day. It's paralyzing. All the experts interviewed by the Times praised the general planning for a new administration, but several felt it was not aggressive enough. The pandemic is raging so far beyond control, they argued, that it can be contained only with deeply unpopular but necessary measures, such as rigorously enforced mask laws, closing bars and restaurants, requiring regular testing in schools and workplaces, isolating the infected away from their families, and prohibiting travel from high prevalence areas to low prevalence areas, and imposing quarantines that are enforced rather than merely requested. Look, I think that there are more and more people who are paying attention to some of these restrictions. One of the points that they made is that in terms of the travel on Thanksgiving, there was more travel than the public health experts wanted, certainly. But travel was down by over half. They say that there were 40% as many people who traveled on Thanksgiving as there were in 2019. Before there was the, of course, the coronavirus alarm. All of this also goes to another story that I think actually helps put this entire matter into some perspective and just how serious it really is. In Newsweek, there's a piece by Ewan Palmer, and it begins, a Jewish doctor in California has described how his compassion was tested while he treated a man whose body was covered with Nazi tattoos amid the spiraling COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Taylor Nichols, an emergency room physician at Mercy San Juan Hospital near Sacramento, shared a story about the conflict he experienced treating a man who was having difficulty breathing while he dealt with the fallout of people not listening or flat out refusing to follow health guidelines to protect against the virus. He looked sick, uncomfortable, scared, Nichols tweeted. As we got him over to the gurney and his shirt off to switch to a hospital gown, we all noticed the number of Nazi tattoos. Nichols added that the, quote, solidly built man also showed signs of years of methamphetamine use, including his teeth being mostly gone. But the medical staff treating the man, which also included a black nurse and an Asian respiratory therapist, also noticed the tattoos on the patient's body. The swastika stood out boldly on his chest. SS tattoos and other insignia that had previously been covered by his shirt were now obvious to the whole room, Nichols said. Don't let me die, doc, the patient said, gasping for breath, as the RT switched him over from CPAP, a breathing aid, by EMS ambulance services, to our mask and machine. I assured him that we were all going to work hard to take care of him and keep him alive as best we could. Nichols added, we all saw the symbols of hate on his body outwardly and proudly announced his views. We all knew what he thought of us, how he valued our lives. Yet here we were, working seamlessly as a team, to make sure we gave him the best chance to survive that we could, all while wearing masks, gowns, face shields, gloves. The moment perfectly captured what we are going through as healthcare workers as this pandemic accelerates. Hope that acceleration is over and we get something back like normalcy. What about normalcy in politics and the success of Republicans on every ballot position except president, it seemed? We'll be right back. The Michael Medved Show. It's a pleasure to welcome John McCormick, whose work I admire. He is a Washington correspondent at National Review, and he is a fellow at the National Review Institute. We spoke yesterday a little bit about his new piece, which is posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. It's called Why Republicans Picked Up House Seats Even While Trump Lost. John, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me here, Michael.
Well, it's a pleasure. Look, you make an important point and actually put it in historical context, which is that there really wasn't that much of a difference between President Trump's performance in this election and the Republicans running for the House and the Senate. Because in a lot of these states, it was close on both sides. But generally, and you go back to 2016, where there was a huge difference between a lot of the senatorial candidates in swing states, Republicans who did very well, and Trump, who just barely eked out victory in those states. Why do you think there was less of a difference between Trump and his Republican running mates this time than there was the first time Trump ran for office?
Well, I think in 2016, you know, you had more of these traditional Republican voters in the suburbs were willing to vote for the Republicans for Senate, but maybe not for Trump for the presidential race. And I think that over the last 4 years, with this convergence between, you know, Trump in the White House and the Republicans in the Senate working hand in glove, and, you know, every single Republican except for Mitt Romney opposing impeachment, and really no one really besides Ben Sasse criticizing Trump, there's, you know, for those independent voters, those swing voters, they might have gone for Biden this time rather than and for the Democrat as well. Whereas last time around, I think that they were more inclined to split their tickets. You also had a lot of, I would guess a lot of the Gary Johnson voters back in 2016. I think they voted for Republicans and, you know, in the Senate races. I'm not sure. There just weren't a lot of those Gary Johnson voters this time. I'm thinking they were Biden voters. Again, this is somewhat speculative, but I mean, it's pretty clear that there was a big difference. And, you know, I mean, in Georgia last time, you know, Trump won by 5 points, and the Republican Senator Johnny Isaacson, who's, you know, no great politician in and of himself, he won by 13 or 14 points. This time around in Georgia, Trump lost by 0.25 points, you know, a quarter of a point. And David Perdue, he advanced the runoff, didn't win outright. He did 1.8 points better. But if you look at all these other states, you know, it is pretty close. You know, in states where Trump lost, the Republican Senate candidate lost, maybe by a little more, maybe by a little less than Trump. And in the states where Trump won, the Senate candidates won again, maybe by a little bit more, maybe by a little bit less, but not quite seeing the same kind of big divergences that we did in 2016. For example, Marco Rubio, he won by 8 points in Florida. Trump won by one. Trump again won by 3 points in Florida. There just wasn't a Senate race on the ballot this time. But it's just interesting. Each year, 2012, 2016, 2020, you know, it's a different coalition. Different things happen. I mean, in 2012, you go back to Mitt Romney, Romney lost the national popular vote by 4 points, and Republicans, I think this has a lot to do with the nature of the coalition of the voters, that they were more concentrated in the suburbs. They were able to hold on to a House majority with 233 seats. This time around, Republicans are at 213 seats. That's great compared to where people thought they were going to be. You know, I think a lot of people thought that Republicans were going to lose seats in this election. The polls were obviously off. They were off in Senate races. They were off in presidential races. They were off in House races. But the results are broadly consistent, you know, with the narrow loss in the presidential race. And that's what you'd expect, is for Republicans to gain seats after that 2018 blowout. You know, in a tighter race in 2020, you'd expect Republicans to gain seats down ballot, even though they didn't.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point I think that's a very important point that you make in your column and your analysis in National Review, and I recommend that people take a look at it. I was fascinated by a brand new Gallup poll this morning that shows that very much as expected, it's very usual when there's a new president-elect, he has a bounce in the polls. And there's talk that the approval rating for Joe Biden may be up 4 points since he was declared the winner on November 7th. And what is unusual is usually the defeated candidate, whoever that is also looked upon more favorably because no longer the enemy. President Trump is down in terms of his approval rating. What would you advise for the president? Because he doesn't want to leave office at some kind of valley in his approval, does he? I mean, wouldn't it be better for the Republican Party and for President Trump's own future if he left with a blaze of popularity? How could he achieve that best?
I think he obviously would be, I mean, as I would say, first, you know, we should take a, know, grain of salt when we talk about any of these polls. Obviously, you know, the selection show they can be off, you know, maybe by 5 points, 4 or 5, 6 points. You know, they're not off by 10 or 20 points, we know that much. But I do think that I would guess that that's right, that the polls, you know, it's heading in the right, they're directionally correct, and that people are, you know, turned off by the president not being gracious in defeat. You know, I think it's important to tell the whole truth here. And the whole truth is that this was a very close election. It was just as close, actually, in the Electoral College as the 2016 election, which was legitimate. Trump's win was legitimate, as much as some Democrats tried to pretend it wasn't afterwards. And it even came down, you know, in the same way that, you know, 2016 came down to those three states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Basically, there were 77,000 votes in those three states. If they had gone the other way, Hillary Clinton would have won the election. Well, this time around, it was three different states because, you know, it's a different collection of states that put Joe Biden over 270. And if 44,000 voters in Wisconsin and Georgia and Arizona had gone differently, you know, Trump would have been reelected. It would have gone to the House in a 269-269 tie. And, you know, Republicans had the votes in the House to make Trump president again. That's not the case. You know, and a 44,000 vote win across three states is the same as a 77,000 vote win across three states. And I think the people would just they would more greatly admire the president if he were gracious. I mean, I think that we all saw, you know, that people do respond differently to how he behaves. I mean, the first debate, he behaved deplorably and his poll numbers went down. And after the second debate, he, you know, for the president, he was fairly presidential. You know, a lot of.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this very quickly before we run out of time here. Do you believe there's anything to be gained by continuing to pursue these charges that President Trump actually won the election and he lost because of fraud? Is there any gain for the Republican cause or the conservative cause?
Well, no, I mean, it's not true. I mean, most importantly, that, you know, I've looked into, I mean, the Dominion voting machines conspiracy makes zero sense when you consider that these are printed paper ballots in Georgia. They print out the name of which candidate you supported. They just did a hand recount where individual human beings looked at which candidate was written down on that printed ballot and sorted them into piles, and the votes basically matched up. You know, they had some corrections, but not a lot. There's a sense of grievance for people who like to stoke the sense of grievance, you know, to create a brand or a TV show off of it. And I think that there's, you know, there's money to be made. I just don't think it's right. It's not true. And the truth is what matters most here.
That's John McCormick, who is Washington correspondent at National Review. He is a fellow at National Review Institute. And by the way, for people who like to pronounce the premature death of the Republican Party, as, of course, people on the left have been doing forever, they ought to check out his new piece at National Review about the Republican successes in this election. More on those successes and a truly stunning success at fundraising. We'll get to that coming up on The Medved Show. Well, today, the 1st of December, is known as Giving Tuesday. And if you're going to be participating in this new tradition in our great nation, here on the Michael Medved Show, I hope you'll consider going to our website, to michaelmedved.com, and clicking on the banner for the American Council on Science and Health, ACSH. Click right there and be part of their work, which depends on donations. ACSH continues to be an invaluable resource to policymakers, to journalists, to scientists, doctors, patients, and news consumers like you and me. Over the past 10 months, ACSH has produced 476 articles with monthly page views on their website above 500,000. The experts like Dr. Alex Barazal, who's been frequently on this show, have appeared in 479 media outlets throughout the world. So at this time of giving thanks, we just did that last week, of course, it's appropriate for me to express my gratitude to you and hope that all of you will continue to join and support the growing number of ACSH, American Council on Science and Health, supporters. And you can do that by going directly to our website, to michaelmedved.com. Okay, speaking about fundraising, and this is just amazing. This is just incredible. This is the New York Times reporting, and it was reported too early to get into the newspaper today with all of the official news. President Trump has continued, and if those of you have emails like mine, I know this because I get the emails all the time from the Trump campaign. Trump campaign has continued its political operation since Election Day. How much have they raised since Election Day? Wouldn't you think it would be a lot? Well, that's $170 million. That's right. Today is, let's see, what are we, 3 weeks? 4 weeks. We're 4 weeks from Election Day. And they've raised $170 million? The Trump campaign, reports the Times, has continued to aggressively solicit donations with appeals that have funded his attempts to overturn the election and that have seeded his post-presidential political ambitions. Most of the money is raised where the fine print shows that the first 75% of every contribution goes to a new political action committee that Trump set up in mid-November, starting a week after the election. It's called Save America, and it can be used to fund his political activities going forward, including staff and travel, and a potential campaign to return to power in 2024. So people who pay attention to what we mentioned before, which is a slight downtick in his approval rating, no one should underestimate the continued popularity, devotion to President Trump by literally tens of millions of Americans. There's also good news on the House of Representatives. I mentioned earlier today in California's 25th district, a state assemblywoman, Christy Smith, a Democrat who had given up her seat to try to challenge Representative Mike Garcia, the Republican, just conceded. Garcia has won the race. Now, what does that mean? That means every single Republican incumbent who ran for re-election in this election cycle won. That's right. The only places where Democrats gained anything at all, I think there were three of them, were where Republicans had retired. I think in one case it was somebody who had lost in a primary. In New York's 24th district, John Katko, who's a very good guy, defeated somebody who had run against him before. Representative Katko won over Dana Balter. In the Georgia Senate race, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is spending $2 million for an issue advocacy ad, boosting Senator Perdue, Republican, and Senator Kelly Loeffler, Republican. They're both in this runoff coming up January 5th. But they encourage them in this issue ad to keep fighting for pandemic relief. And that's very appropriate today when there's a bipartisan group of senators led by Joe Manchin and Mitt Romney and Susan Collins and others who are trying to get that panic relief through. Meanwhile, John Ossoff, who is running against Senator David Perdue, he is the Democrat, the documentary filmmaker. He has a new ad where he features a familiar voice, somebody he hopes will be able to lend some of his popularity to his attempt to knock off the incumbent Republican Senator David Perdue. Here is that clip 8, that John Ossoff new ad.
John Ossoff has dedicated his career to fighting injustice. He learned about public service from one of my lifelong heroes, John Lewis. He knows we need a new Voting Rights Act that makes sure every Georgian is treated equally under the law. John's wife, Alicia, is a doctor. He's going to listen to the experts to get this pandemic under control. If we vote like our lives depend on it, because they do, we will elect John Ossoff to the United States Senate.
I'm John Ossoff, and I approve this message.
That, of course, was President Obama. And will he be back to Georgia to try to help John Ossoff and Reverend Raphael Warnock? Possible, but I think more and more things are looking like the two Republican candidates have to be favored to win re-election here. Now, one thing that, who knows, it's sort of a wild card, is the schedule right now calls for President Trump to come down there and to campaign for Perdue and for Loeffler. And again, it's absolutely crucial for the Republicans who voted for President Trump, who made it a very, very close race in the state of Georgia, to come out again and not to get discouraged. The difficulty is, and this was something that was asked to Ronna McDaniel when she was speaking to a crowd of Georgia voters, also trying to make sure that Republicans turn up in this runoff on January 5th. How does it help getting people to turn up for your side if you say the election is rigged? There's another problem with this. If President Trump comes down there to campaign for Perdue and Loeffler, it'll be important to get everybody, all Republicans, together, united behind these two candidates, on whom, by the way, control of the U.S. Senate depends. And that means also having people like the governor of the state of Georgia, conservative Republican Brian Kemp, also take part in it. And President Trump has just been making war on Brian Kemp and on the Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, because they have not gone along with his strategy about fighting the vote counting in Georgia. All of the five states that that Joe Biden flipped in his direction have now been certified. And can they still be challenged in court? That's still going on. But all of this will be counted by the Electoral College officially on December 14th. President Trump sent out this tweet today. He sent out, "Why won't Governor Brian Kemp, the hapless governor of Georgia, use his emergency powers, which can be easily done, to overrule the obstinate Secretary of State," another Republican, "and do a match of signatures on envelopes? It will be a gold mine of fraud, and we can easily win the vote." Actually, the matching signatures to ballots is impossible, because they already did that when these votes came in. And then you take the ballot out of the envelope. You're not supposed to be able to tell how anyone, John Smith or Donald Trump, actually voted. Secret ballot, right? Let us hope that the party gets itself together and that President Trump has a successful and rousing trip where he helps to raise enthusiasm for Georgians to re-elect those Republican senators on behalf of this greatest nation on God's green earth.